The current Queen of the United Kingdom, Elizabeth II, has to be the most well-documented monarch in history. She's not only served longer than any other, but her reign falls completely within the television era. Media and men were very different during the reign of the first Queen Elizabeth. Elizabeth I, daughter of Henry VIII, is a figure well known in our time, but how accurately? Our next guest dug deep through the layers of belief created by other historians for his book, Elizabeth, The Forgotten Years. John Guy is a historian of Tudor England, a prolific author about the time, and an award winner for his books. Queen of Scots, The True Life of Mary Stuart, won the Whitbread Biography Award. John Guy is no stranger to broadcasting either. He's hosted documentaries on BBC and is called upon often as a radio and TV commentator. John Guy, a pleasure to have you today on the Jefferson Exchange.
It's a pleasure, Jeff. Good morning.
Well, good morning. It seems like historical works written soon after the events can certainly skew later views and works. Tell us about the difficulty you found with William Camden's efforts to capture the life of Elizabeth not long after it ended.
The thing about William Camden was that, like Winston Churchill, he said that history will be kind to me because I intend to write it. The thing about Camden is that William Cecil, Lord Burghley, who had been Elizabeth's chief minister for much of the reign, had commissioned Camden to write the life of Elizabeth. Camden, though, was working under James VI of Scotland, who became James I of England in 1603. And the thing about James was that, of course, he was the son of Mary Stuart, whom Elizabeth had famously executed. So Burghley and Cecil, this was very complicated and difficult territory. So that Camden liked to miss out things that were controversial. He also decided that he would just make Elizabeth look great and glorious, to play up her role as a queen. And this rather overlooks the problem of being a woman ruler in a man's world in the 16th century.
You force us to think about process, I think, in ways that I had never thought about before, and that is in realizing that a lot of historians write their works from using the works of earlier historians as their sources, which can really be a problem if the first works were skewed.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that in the same way as in my book on Mary, Queen of Scots, Mary Stuart, with the Elizabeth, I have just gone back to the original sources, and there are tons of them. Even for these later years, you're looking at, by the later years, I mean life begins at 50 for Elizabeth. I'll maybe explain that in a moment. But there are something like 250,000 pages to search, of manuscript pages. You know, there is no lack of source materials here. The problem is quite the opposite. You know, it takes years to go through this stuff. I've been in this game now for almost 40 years. I've been working on this book for the best part of 10 years. I did the Mary now 2004, that's 14 years ago. There's a huge amount of stuff here.
So what kind of stuff and what kind of shape is it in after 400 plus years?
Okay, well, some of it's been catalogued, but much of it hasn't been catalogued. And if you know the archives, you know where to look. Again, you have to just dig in all the different classes of material, financial records, correspondence, documents that show you where people were at particular times, because that makes an enormous difference. You also have to travel. I mean, England wasn't simply separate from the rest of Europe at that time. Much of these years that I'm interested in, the later years of Elizabeth after she became 50, these were war years, war with Spain, war with the Catholic League in France. You have to go to Brussels, you have to go to Paris, you have to go to Spain.
So you mentioned this is a 10-year project. After, I don't know, 2 years, 5 years, seven, did you begin to feel like, aha, now I think I understand Elizabeth in ways that has not been portrayed in other works of literature or in movies, certainly?
Well, Jeff, that's exactly the point, because you realize that we're dealing here with the first, that not just, she's not the first woman ruler of England, because her half-sister Mary Tudor had been the first woman ruler immediately before Elizabeth. But Mary Tudor had married and had a husband, and he was king. The point about the 16th century is that if you're an unmarried ruler, and Elizabeth is the first unmarried ruler, then if you marry, your husband will expect to be king, and gender will overcome rank. No one in the 16th century thought that rank could overcome gender. Now, for Elizabeth, she wants to hold on to power, but her councillors, her male councillors, find this a very difficult situation, and they cannot believe that a woman can rule entirely on her own. They think that they need to be, at the very least, her partners, helping her, controlling her, protecting her from herself. Now, of course, they aim to marry her. And for the first, you know, the first half of the reign, the first 20, 22, 23 years of the reign, they want to get her married. But of course, once she's past the menopause, there is no point trying to do that. And one of the central theses of this book is that once Elizabeth had passed the menopause, and no one in the 16th century knew when that really was for a woman, the woman herself would probably know, but even women didn't understand much about their own gynecology then. It was a very primitive age for medicine. But everybody knew that when she'd passed the age of 50, there was no point in marrying her off anymore. And so my point is that that was the moment when she could decide that she would really liberate herself from these counselors and begin to rule as well as reign.
So real
thing, thing is, though, Jeff, that this is also the time when she also has to start fighting a war. Her father, Henry VIII, had always said that a woman couldn't rule. It was incredibly dangerous. If she ruled, she'd have to find a husband. But it would be in wartime that it would be most obvious that a woman couldn't rule because she couldn't lead an army.
And so from essentially 1584 on, England was at war?
From the moment 1584 is when essentially Europe falls into crisis. The war begins in earnest in 1587, when after the execution of Mary Queen of Scots, and of course in 1588, Spain sends the first of five Spanish armadas, but the most famous Spanish armada comes in 1588.
All right, much more to talk about with John Guy. His book is Elizabeth, The Forgotten Years. We're talking about Elizabeth I of England and bearing the benefits of John's extensive research into documents hundreds of years old. You'll hear more from him, and we hope to hear from you as well when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the British historian John Guy, who has come out with another thick book about somebody from the Tudor years. Well, Mary Tudor, Elizabeth Tudor in this case. The book is Elizabeth, The Forgotten Years. John has also written Queen of Scots and several other books that are highly regarded. One of his great things is that he has gone far back into the archives and dug up lots of records that heretofore had not seen the light of day in quite a long time. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the real Elizabeth he found as opposed to the one portrayed on TV and in movies. 800-838-3760 to join the discussion. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So a couple of different versions of Elizabeth in the later years, if movies even ever get there. Either bold autocrat or sex-starved spinster seems to be what comes out of earlier works. Do either of those hold much weight for you now, John?
Well, she's certainly not a sex-starved spinster. You know, there was this story which really was thought up by Lytton Strachey, who was writing in 1928, who understood that these later years were very different to the earlier years. He knew that the texture of the period was completely different, but he had simply assumed that Elizabeth, you know, now that she was, if you like, free to be her own woman, had a passion for this much younger man, Robert Devereux, the second Earl of Essex. She certainly allowed him too much rope, but I don't think she was ever in love with him. And of course, the problem was also that he was one of the generals, and he refused to obey her orders. In the end, she cut him off. She simply, you know, banished him from access to the court. He tried to lead a rising against her. She had him executed.
Wow, that's a real sense of breakup there. Did any of the men, when we come back to the idea, it's difficult to recall when we live in today's world where we have women in positions of power around the world, that there were none at the time. So did any of the men that Elizabeth had to rely upon see her as even an equal, let alone a greater force?
Well, they had to come to do so. And you know, much of that, this is really where 1586 and 1587, at this beginning of this period, is quite important, because just at the moment when the war was starting to break out, and Elizabeth knew that Mary, Queen of Scots, who had been plotting against her, it would have to be killed. But of course, the thing about Elizabeth is that Mary was also a fellow woman ruler. And what Elizabeth stood for, above all else, was the ideal of monarchy. The fact that Mary was a Catholic and Elizabeth was a Protestant came second in her mind. But of course, to the men around her who'd made their careers in the new Protestant England since, you know, essentially the death of Henry VIII, those people were absolutely determined that there should be a Protestant successor. And this is where there's a major clash. Elizabeth knows that Mary has to be executed, but she doesn't want to actually do it as an act of state. She doesn't want to sign the death warrant. She actually wants Mary to be assassinated quietly in the night, like Richard II, you know, with a pillow in the Tower of London, or you know, what by whatever way. But of course, the men around her, they con her into signing the warrant by telling her that the Spanish Armada has landed already, which actually hadn't. So they frighten her into signing a warrant, but she tells them that basically they're not yet to use it. She's not ready, but they send it anyway. Now, you might think that a lot of historians, most previous historians, have said that this was almost like a great act of republicanism, and in some ways it was. But of course, Elizabeth got her own back. She humiliated these people. She actually made them. She pulled them up into court. She fired one of them from his office. Burley, she wouldn't talk to for 6 months. She established her authority, which she was able to do as mature woman. And after that point, although people like Essex, people like Sir Walter Raleigh, who of course was famous, is famous now in the United States because he attempted to found the first colony at Roanoke, which is which they called Virginia, which of course you know is near Manteo. And the fact of the matter is that even Raleigh was subjected to Elizabeth.
You write of Elizabeth understanding the relationship of words to power in Elizabeth the Forgotten Years. What do you mean by that?
I mean that she had been trained. One thing she had got was a first-class education, and she was a master of words. She wasn't in Shakespeare's sort of league, far from, but she knew how to write and how to give extemporary speeches. In that age, remember, in that age, there's no phones, there's no TV, there's no faxes, there's no internet. It's essentially you establishing your authority, and much of that of authority is by the way you talk, the way you dress, you know, the way you appear in public. And one of the things that our previous historians have tried to argue is that Elizabeth, you know, she used to win over foreign ambassadors. She used not just words, but she used, if you like, sexy clothing, sort of exposing even her bosom, you know, so that you know they could sort of salivate over it. But this all stems from an inaccurate translation of a diplomatic diary. And one of the things I was able to cover was in the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris, which is the main library in Paris, the original dispatches of the ambassador in question. And in fact, what Elizabeth was able to do was to win him over by words. But words, and if you like, her sheer physical presence, her dress, were able to win this chap over. And she would do something like she would take her gloves off and show him her long, elegant fingers. You know, that was enough.
In those days, certainly. As you went into the archival material, I mean, I'm guessing you read enough of things that were in Elizabeth's hand and or voice that you could suss out after a while which ones were by or from her, even though they were not necessary. They might have been dictated to somebody else, in other words.
Well, that's right. Well, the thing about this is that, you know, I mean, there are all these letters that are written here, you know, I mean, in the entire reign. You know, maybe 15,000 letters and warrants that went out in her name. She didn't write all those. At the most, I reckon that maybe, you know, she reigns for overall for nearly 44 years. Maybe 2,500 of those, you know, she actually wrote. We actually know what happened in 1567. The Spanish ambassador actually is waiting in the queue for an audience with the Queen. He sees Robert Dudley, one of the councillors, one of Elizabeth's favourites from the early part of the reign. He comes to the front of the queue. He jumps the queue. He writes a letter in Elizabeth's name. He goes in and gets her to sign it. You don't hear Elizabeth's voice unless you actually know which bits of the documents she wrote and which bits were written by other people. And to do that, you have to slog, not read what's been printed before, but go into the archives and slog through what's in her handwriting, what she corrected. You see the battles. You know, I mean, imagine going into, say, into a U.S. presidential archive, and you can see the policy process being, you know, actually taking place before your eyes, because you would see something written by a Secretary of State, something written by an advisor to a Secretary of State, something written, by a political advisor or, you know, whatever it was. And then the President of the United States actually scoring through some of that stuff, writing his own stuff or her, maybe as it will be after the next election, her own stuff. over that. That's the way that you do it. But by unpicking this use of language, by unpicking these verbal exchanges, you're also getting inside the politics of the period, and you're understanding the relationships, the power play between these male courtiers and the Queen. And Elizabeth, through the use of language, could often pull this off. She would swear. She could be, you know, I mean, she did all the things, you know, that that modern male rulers are supposed to do in that way. But she was also very cool, collected. And although she had these temper tantrums, you know, she knew when to step back. As well as to strike.
The book is called Elizabeth, The Forgotten Years. John Guy is its author and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. You may join the discussion. Maybe you have some questions about Elizabeth that you've been dying to ask somebody. Here's somebody who should know. 800-838-3760 on the phone. Email is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Connie and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
I have a question, you know, whether it's in film, plays, books, you always see Elizabeth, especially as queen, surrounded by men and, you know, and various power plays by men. And I wondered, was there any kind of mentor of any kind? Obviously, there's not another queen particularly, but was there any other mentors, women mentors, when she was younger? And then even while she was queen and older, were there a younger or similar age woman who acted as more of a confidant and someone with whom she could bounce ideas? In other words, a person other than the males all around her that she could confide in.
All right, somebody to share her inner thoughts. Good question. Thanks for that, Connie.
Yeah, well, that's a really good question. Early in Elizabeth's life, when she was a teenager, remember in those days, when you were a baby onwards, you didn't live with your mother. In royal palaces, you were separated from your parents and put under, if you were a boy, under essentially in a separate household, a separate nursery, a separate prince's household, or if you were a girl, you were put under a governess. And you were brought up by her, and you were educated by professional educators, by tutors. Elizabeth had a governess called Catherine Ashley, Cat Ashley, and she was somebody who was very, very close to the Queen. After she died, there were others. Elizabeth actually is very vulnerable. She can't sleep alone. She needs one of her women attendants who are close to her. Remember, the men couldn't come into the bedchamber, So it's in the bedchamber that you would see those sort of conversations. Later in the reign, in the years that I call the forgotten years, there's a woman called Catherine Carey, Kate Carey, who becomes Charles is the man who leads the English fleet against the Spanish Armada, and in the end she makes him Earl of Nottingham. And so Kate Carey is the Countess of Nottingham, and Elizabeth is said to be very, very close to Kate Carey. But in the 16th century, it wasn't possible for women really to meddle very much in politics. Both Cat Ashley is known on a number of occasions to have spoken to ambassadors, but it seems when you look more closely into this that when she did so, she was put up to it either by the Queen to mislead them or to dupe them into thinking that, you know, they might think one thing when she wanted the, when she wanted them. Essentially to think that, and then she would put them off their guard and then deal with them when they came to see her. That sort of thing. Or sometimes the men councillors would use the women in the Privy Chamber to assess the Queen's mood. You know, they would try and, you know, make contact with them. They would try and build working relationships with those women for leaking how the Queen was today. But it's impossible to prove the extent of that influence of the women courtiers as around her, because there just aren't any written records. There are just no written records. But there are also what you would expect to find if there really was significant influence is eruptions with the men complaining that the women had been meddling in politics. And with the exception of a couple of instances, two or three instances with Cat Ashley, you don't really get that.
So men in power obviously did not think much of women in positions of power. What did Elizabeth's subjects feel? What were you able to establish about her popularity with the people she ruled?
Well, one of the great myths about Elizabeth is that, you know, we're told by Camden in the, you know, the Annales, which you mentioned, you know, right at the beginning, and of course those were bowdlerized by translators after Elizabeth's death, and all sorts of things were put in that, you know, wherever she went, the people cried, you know, God save the Queen, and etc. and they cheered her. You know, we're led to believe one part of Elizabeth's rhetoric is that she was not exactly a people's queen, because she was really quite a snob. She didn't believe that people should marry of different social status. The aristocracy should never marry commoners or that sort of thing. She didn't actually want to talk to any of the ordinary people. But she cultivated this myth that somehow she was their protector and their queen, and that everybody cried wherever she went. You know, everybody cried, "God save the Queen," and sort of cheered her to the rafters. But actually, there's no real evidence for this. These were some when this Elizabethan war against Spain was a war that was longer than the First and the Second World Wars combined. I mean, it starts in 1587. It's still going strong in 1601. And peace isn't actually made until after Elizabeth's death. So, and because of this war, there is no trade. Prices soar. Food is more expensive in those years than it was at any time between 1066 and the beginning of the 20th century. It's absolutely phenomenal. There's massive unemployment. Elizabeth treats the people who fought for her in the land war in northern France against the French Catholic League. She treats the mariners who fought for her on the Armada incredibly badly. When they come back wounded, basically she ignores them. She doesn't pay their arrears of pay. She won't help them. If they come to London and demand their wages, they're ordered to be hanged. I mean, it's private individuals and actually Parliament intervened to make the Queen award some of these people quite small pensions so that they could just about hold body and soul together without begging. But Elizabeth, as good Queen Bess, doesn't come out of this well, whereas she's living in finery in her royal palaces, eating the finest food. And by the way, the Queen can use the royal prerogative in the period that I'm writing about to actually order that food suppliers, you know, there aren't really any shops, but there are markets in the towns where, you know, where she is, or in London, that, that food suppliers supply the royal court with food at prices that she decides, that have no real relation to, you know, the actual cost of food. So this is not a great record.
One of the major revelations I find in here is the idea that Elizabeth was still going to attempt to sue for peace with Spain as the Armada was on its way, the first Armada.
Well, that was, you know, Jeff, that was probably the luckiest strike I had, because I went to Brussels, and which of course from London is really quite easy. You just take the train and it goes under the Channel Tunnel. But you know, I was there for a week or so, and looking at all the documents and trawling through them. But there was one box of files that I could never get to order. I could never get them to bring up, because there was some problem with the way that the computer interpreted the references. But about 50 minutes before I was due to leave to get my train, they brought me up this pile of documents, which was it was nearly 2 feet high. And I rummaged through it, and I found this file. And I had my digital camera with me. They let you take photographs there. I just took something like 200 photographs, you know, just straight away, and got all this stuff and read it when I got back home. And in there, I found that Elizabeth was still groveling for peace on the most abject terms. She just feared an invasion by Spain. She feared that if the Spanish Armada really did land, essentially she would be toppled. And she was negotiating, she was offering whatever terms Spain, would give if only they would basically leave her alone. Of course, she was completely duped, because Philip II of Spain and his diplomats, who were doing these negotiations, they just used these negotiations to lull her into a false sense of security, while they actually rearmed and actually sent the Armada.
A fascinating book that really gives us a whole new perspective on Elizabeth. It's called Elizabeth, the Forgotten Years. John Guy is the British historian who put it together. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.